So I don't know if you noticed that Sebastian broke a string and had to pick up a different guitar than what he was used to, and his expectations for the night were somewhat shattered. That happens sometimes, doesn't it? We go through life and we have our expectations for how things should be, and a lot of times it doesn't work like that, right? So about 1 year ago, pretty much on the dot, maybe like next week a year ago, I got the flu, the respiratory flu, really for the first time. I've never felt anything like that before. I had this intense week of what I would call suffering, with achiness and all the, it's amazing how it just gets, like your whole body's messed up, your lungs and everything else. And so right when I got done with it, all symptoms had gone away mostly. I still had kind of a stuffy nose and things like that. About a week later, I came to church, I sang for a while, and I noticed my ears kind of feeling a little fuzzy and foggy. And then we were at our house later that day, and I was like, all of a sudden, just like over the matter of like 1 hour, it went from feeling pretty okay to the most excruciating pain I've ever felt in my life. And I've broken bones, and I broke my tailbone once. That was pretty excruciating. But this was like unlike anything I've ever felt in my life before. And I went upstairs to just sort of lay down and try to deal with it. Sarah came in a little bit later and found me literally pulling my hair out. You know you're in pain when there's a part of you that somehow thinks that causing pain in another part of your body is going to alleviate the pain. Pulling my hair out because it hurts so bad. And then all of a sudden there was blood and my eardrum burst and I couldn't hear. And I had about 2 weeks of agonizing pain. Went to the emergency room that night. About 2 weeks of agonizing pain, the flu virus had gone into my ear. And the pain was one thing. I would call that suffering. But on a different level for me in my heart, I had a battle going on because the most important thing to me in life, other than serving God, loving His church, and my family, is music. And for almost 3 months, I only heard distortion on this side. Anytime I heard sound. For a while, I couldn't hear anything. And I was wrestling, going, God, why would you take the enjoyment of music away from me? What's the point of this? And so we're going to talk about some things today and over the next couple of weeks, centered a little bit around what we're going to do next week, and that's going to be talking a little bit more about past wounding and the idea of forgiveness and maybe even going home for Thanksgiving to people who perhaps maybe you've had some issues with over the years. You feel some wounds and hurts and pains, but tonight I want to give kind of an introduction and just talk about pain. Talk about suffering in general, not just from past wounds, but other things. Could be an ear infection. And I think we have to start off by understanding that every single one of us starts off when we suffer, when we experience pain, here's where we go. Why? One certainty in life, every single one of us as human beings will suffer at some point or other. If you're not suffering right now, you know someone who is, most likely. And this is the first place we go. It's like instinct. It's built into us. We go, why am I suffering? What is the point of this? And I've wrestled with this topic for years. It's one of the hardest ones to get in our heads. It's like, what is the point? Why is there pain in the world? And you hear philosophers talk about it with the problem of evil. And they go down all these intellectual and logical roads. And then you hear physicians talk about it. And you hear psychologists talk about it and analyze what's going on in the head. And you hear counselors talk about it with interpersonal relationships. And somehow all these things are combined together in this nuanced, really intricate thing that is human life. And our experience of pain, and oftentimes that pain is really multifaceted. And so I've read a lot of things over the years. Disappointment with God. Where is God when it hurts? The problem of evil. And one of the things that I've come to just really, really value is this one book in the Bible that's kind of unlike anything else in the Bible. And it's the book of Job. I think the book of Job is brilliant. It's masterful. It has this sort of intellectual, philosophical honesty. It's just right there in the middle of the Bible. And when you read it, sometimes you end up with more questions. But I think there's some profound, profound truths And you could teach the book of Job for 6 months, and I only have 25 minutes tonight, so we're not going to do that. But I do want to eke out a truth that's found in the first chapter. And it might leave us with some more questions, and that's okay. We can dialogue. We can think about it over the next few weeks. It's okay to leave things a little bit open-ended. But I have kind of one major point that I want to make and sort of three sub-points in the midst of that. But what I'm going to do first is read this piece of Job, because I think we get a little bit of an insight into what God is doing when he allows suffering. If you want to read along with me, that's fine. It'll be page 417 in your house Bible. I'm going to start on verse 8. So, preface here is there's this guy named Job. He's really rich. He's got a lot of stuff. He's got a lot of kids. He's really happy. And then Satan comes to God. And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You've blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and there came a messenger to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing, the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was yet speaking, there came another that said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was yet speaking, there came another that said, "The Chaldeans formed three groups and made a raid on the camels and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young people, and they are dead, and I alone have escaped to tell you." And then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshipped. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. So I think there's sort of three pieces of advice that this chapter has for us. Just a quick summary. Number one, and I'm going to go into each one of these, avoid pat answers to the why question of suffering. Avoid pat answers. Number two, embrace living potentially without an answer to the why question. And then three, anticipate the ultimate answer to the why question. And so we're going to start with the first one, avoiding pat answers. I think there's two common traps people fall into. And the first one is basically like when religious people suffer, when church people suffer. We'd probably be among this crowd. It's not all of us, but this kind of tends to be where we go. People respond saying, "Why is God punishing me? Maybe I need to go to church more. Maybe I need to pray more." A lot of people in church, when you say, "Hey, I'm suffering," they'll say, "Well, you know, if you're sick, you don't have enough faith. If you're not financially prospering enough, you don't have enough faith. You don't believe. You haven't named it and claim it," or whatever else it is. And I would call that moralism. The idea that God's up there doing tit for tat, and, you know, if your life is good, that means you're living good. If your life is bad, if you're encountering suffering, that means somehow you've sinned, you haven't, you know, prayed enough or something. That's sort of the first easy pat answer that people fall into. "Well, you're suffering, so this must be what's wrong." And then there's a second one, and it's more kind of where more secular people go, or maybe more cynical people go, and that is basically that cynicism happens. And I think the idea with this one is it's just kind of random. Life is random. There's no real meaning. A lot of times, people on the secular side of things that aren't thinking about God too much, they might say, "Well, suffering exists. I'm suffering now, so therefore God cannot exist." And that's a really tough question for a lot of people. Either that or they say, you know, God must be incompetent because he could stop this suffering and he hasn't done it. So either he's incompetent and can't, or he's mean because he's got the power to do it and he won't. But these are pat answers. These are too simple. They're too simple. So look at this. It's where we started. The Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? So first of all, we got the sense from this passage that we just read, God initiated it. He pointed out Job. So God's competent, he's there, he's directing this moment somehow. Have you considered my servant Job, that there's none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? And so Satan's like, oh yeah? You think he fears you? He's just in it for the stuff that you can give him. Take that stuff away, hurt him, allow him to feel pain and suffering and loss, and he's going to turn and curse you. He just likes you for the things that he's getting from you. And so Satan had this basic motivation there to sort of take what God said to be true about Job and expose Job and God as a fraud in the process. Job's only in it for the stuff. And so on one hand, we have to understand also, maybe a couple of things. First of all, you're kind of like, well, what are God and Satan doing, like playing with this poor mortal human being behind the scenes? Seems like they're just sort of messing with him. But if you go down that road, I think you kind of miss the brilliance of what God is doing, because what God is doing, he's saying, no, this is actually true. But there's only one way to prove it out. And that is give Satan just enough leeway, just enough rope, so that it turns back on him and he hangs himself with that rope. He turns out defeated. And then another thing we have to notice is this is not God's idea necessarily to make the bad things happen to Job. Satan brings that up. Okay? And so when we think about pain, we think about suffering, we have to acknowledge, I think, that God made a world that was perfect. It didn't have death in it. It didn't have whirlwinds that came in from all the four corners of the earth to knock a house down and kill your kids. It didn't have that in it. The fall brought about those things. The fall brought about an unraveling of sort of the natural order of the earth. And Satan takes advantage of those mechanisms. Okay? So it's not God that wants to cause the suffering. God doesn't like suffering. So Satan's doing the damage. But then we have to avoid the temptation of going, well, then God is somehow maybe equal power to Satan? No. God is in complete and utter control in this moment. Complete and utter control. We have to acknowledge that. God has the power to stop Satan. This is one thing that I love about the book of Job. There's not an easy answer here, but it's true. A sovereign God who's in complete control allowed Satan a certain amount of leash to do a whole bunch of damage to this guy. So, of course, we're asking the question, why? God's permitting something here. He says, all right, Satan, very well. Take these things away from him. But notice that he places limits on Satan. He doesn't just give him complete control. He says, you can do this, but you can't do this. You can take these things away, but you can't touch him. And in the second chapter of the book, Satan comes back to him, and he's like, hey, he still praised you. God's like, yeah, he's my guy. He loves me. And Satan goes, yes, but let me take away his health. Because what you could take away all of a man's things, but then you take away his health, he'll surely curse you. Because that's what he's in it for. And God then gives him leeway enough to hurt Job in terms of giving him some disease and these boils and this gross just pain. And he says, just spare his life. So again, God places a limit, a sovereign in control limit on Satan. So I think it's doing a couple, there's a couple of things that are happening here. I think first of all, we have to acknowledge Satan's intent here. God's giving him enough leeway to have that intent backfire on Satan. Satan wants to expose Job as a fraud, but what ends up happening is God exposes Satan as a liar, and Satan doesn't understand what's going on. Okay, so it comes back on Satan. He's defeated in the process. It kind of backfires on him. And then there's another piece that we have to look at in terms of Job, is that through the suffering, Job became great. Stop to think about the fact that thousands and thousands of years later, We're sitting in a room in Fort Collins talking about this man's life and his example and how suffering played out in his life. Somehow through this, Satan's trying to discredit the guy, but God's going to elevate him on the other end of it to the point where he's one of the most famous human figures in all of time. And so I think this is telling us a couple of really important things. And the first one is that this is probably how God works with us. So when we encounter suffering, when we encounter pain, when we encounter trial, look to the example in the book of Job and say, you know what, I don't know what's going on behind the scenes, but God's probably working with me in a similar sort of way, and there's a purpose behind it. I'm not sure what that is. He's permitting evil and suffering to come into your life, but it only comes into your life to the degree, just like with Job, that it defeats the intent of Satan. It defeats the intent of the enemy, the actual intent. And it only happens to the degree that it turns you into a great person. So the suffering then defeats itself. And then I think the second thing is we have to acknowledge that Job, in the entire book of Job, if you're familiar with the book of Job, he never gets a why. He never gets an answer to why he's suffering. God never shows up. You get to the end of the book, and God does show up. And the first thing out of God's mouth is, it's not, well, listen, Job, I had this plan that till the end of time, your name would become synonymous with the problem of evil, and people would make a case study out of you, and you would change people's lives, and people would get saved, and their eternal destinies would be transformed into this glorious thing, and it's going to make you great. And he never says that. God never gives him that. I assume at some point somebody had to know that because it's written in the book. But he never seems to tell Job in the story. What he actually says is, who is this that darkens counsel with words without knowledge? Who do you think you are, Job? I'm God. And I know what I'm doing. And so we have the moralist that says, do this and do that, and then God will bless you or hurt you. You have the cynic who just basically says, this is all just random chance. So just do whatever you want. You don't owe God anything or any behavior or anything. But the Bible says these are both pat answers. They're trying to answer this why question of pain, but they're both just ways, I think, for people to give pat answers and stay in control. Like, our biggest temptation as human beings is we want to be in control. But the Bible calls us to serve God even though we may never know the actual reason for our suffering, just like Job. And it's hard to step into that place, because we want to stay in control. And so it's easy for us to go down that route of the quick and pat answer, and actually it can be very damaging when you approach a person who's suffering and say, well, obviously it's because you sinned, or it all just happens for no reason at all, so just suck it up and deal with it. It can be incredibly damaging, and I don't think it's God's intent to have us go down those roads. So remember the second point that I put up, though. We have to, I think, not just be okay with not having an answer. I think there's a reason for us to embrace not having an answer. I don't think we need to know why. Let me explain that. So we go back to this verse that we read, the very first verse that I read, Job 1:8. The Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there's none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? The Old Testament word for fear, the English kind of just doesn't quite do it justice. The Old Testament word for fear is a lot more positive. It's a little bit more nuanced. It means sort of an inward awe and wonder, sort of a reverent love, as opposed to our English understanding of the word fear. And that's what God is saying in this. There's an inward awe and wonder, a reverent love that Job has for God himself. And so Satan is saying, no, he doesn't love you like that. He's not in awe of you. He just likes you for the things that he's getting from you. So I'm going to expose that now by taking all those things away so he can turn and curse you. It's the things that he loves. It's the money. It's the prosperity. It's the health. It's the status. It's his kids. He doesn't love you. He loves the things he's getting from you. And if any of those things go away, he's just going to be out of there. And so I just want to talk just a little bit about what Satan knows about human nature. I know most of you haven't been in the working world yet or been in a place of influence. If you end up in a place of maybe like middle-level influence or high influence, something like that, you'll find that people will come up to you and act like a friend, act like they care, act like they're interested in your life. But when they realize that you're not going to advance them in their career or give them the thing that they're looking for, they just drop you. And you stop and you start realizing, they weren't actually into me. I was being networked, right? I don't know if you've ever experienced that. Or let's go more serious with it. If you're female in this room, this may have happened to you at this point. Have you ever had a guy act interested in you? Ask the right questions. Take the proper stance. Being respectful to you, only to just completely drop you when he realized you wouldn't sleep with him. How'd that make you feel? It's sort of classic human. You feel objectified. He's not in it for you. From the very start in that transaction, he was looking for it, right? The thing that he could take. And you feel objectified. You feel used because it wasn't you that he wanted. It was a thing. And if you've ever been the perpetrator of something like that, it's kind of equally dehumanizing. Isn't it? Because you're an exploiter. You become hard and cynical, like Satan is about human nature. And I think when Satan looks at people and he makes accusations like the one he made of Job, he's saying, love isn't free. You guys don't know about that. You're not selfless. You're all exploiters, except God is the object. And you're using each other. He says, that's all humans are. And that's his accusation of Job. That's that conversation he's having with God. He doesn't love you for you. You're not elevated in his eyes as a thing to adore. He's just in it for that thing that he wants to use you for. And so I think if we want to be real human beings, we have to understand that there are parts of us. Then there was a part of Job where he was exploiting God and loving the things. And there are things of us, like with me and music. God created music. He created my ear. He gave me those things. He has the right to take those things away from me. But what I realized, and I'm still realizing and still working on it, is that I take music and I elevate it over God. I take the gift from the giver, and I think the gift is the good thing, and I ignore the giver of the thing, when really the giver of the thing is the best thing. And so again, it's hard to say all this in 25 minutes, because there's so many more nuances to it that we could expand on. But I think if we want to learn to love God for who he is in of himself alone, and then sort of as a byproduct of that, love each other for who we are rather than for the things that we can get from each other in terms of using one another. A lot of times, maybe almost always, the way that that happens is through suffering. Because I think the only way for God to make Job into a man of greatness was for Job to go through the suffering. So that on the other end, he loved God for God's sake. And he was kind of refined. And it was kind of exposed in his heart, the things that he was holding on to, that he was elevating above God. And so, just real quick, I think that if God had shown up and given him a glimpse of the reality of what was going on, or if God shows up and gives us a why to why we're currently suffering, like imagine this, you're suffering, but God comes at the very beginning of it, he's like, you're going to go through this 5 years of really, really intense pain, but on the other end of it, There's going to be such a character that's built into you that you'll be qualified to do this amazing thing and advance my kingdom and have this wealth and have this prosperity and this happiness. You go, yeah, I'll take 5 years of pain for that because I see what's on the other end of it. But suddenly we're back in the middle of that equation where we're using God for the thing again. And so it seems to me that maybe it, not knowing why is better. Because then we don't have that temptation. And maybe it's a grace to us that God doesn't expose the why for us. And I think that it's interesting. I shared a couple weeks ago on Sunday morning, there is a certainty that Christians are going to suffer. We're going to encounter hardship and pain. And it seems like the more we follow God, it seems like that escalates even. Like maybe God's behind the scenes with Satan going, hey, look at this one. They're awesome. And Satan's like, yeah, whatever. Let me hurt him. He's like, all right, let's let that happen. It's going to make them great, and it's going to expose you, Satan, for the liar that you are. And I think we also have to acknowledge, too, that we have a little bit more data than Job had to go on. Job made some pretty extreme choices to trust God with very little data. But we have a piece of data, and I'm going to conclude with this, that really leaves us with no excuse. And that piece of data is that God loved us so much that Jesus chose to come into this world as a human being. And centuries after Satan attacked another innocent sufferer who died naked on a cross, screaming, why is this happening to me? My God, why have you forsaken me? And while Job wasn't fully innocent, he was still holding on to some things. He had to be refined through that process. Jesus was completely innocent. Job may have deserved some of the tension, the trial, the suffering. Jesus didn't deserve any of it. And this is what brings me to my very last point. Remember, there are three things. There's one, avoid the pat answers. The two, embrace, maybe not knowing why. But then there's the third one, that for us as Christians who understand that Jesus came to the cross for us, we do have an ultimate final answer that I think balances out the equation for us. And it gives us enough of a why in the long term, the eternal sense, to keep us strong. We've been talking on Sunday mornings now for a while about being mindful of God's presence. I had the last 4 weeks of that. I don't know if you know if you've caught that, but we started off with Aaron Ritter talking about how David strengthened himself in the Lord by being in God's presence. That somehow the person of God himself, not the things that come from him, but the person of God himself is where David found his strength. He found a strategy against the enemy. He found that God went ahead of him and actually beat the enemy down. And he found this place of joy and delight to where he could dance unhindered in God's presence. And I am becoming more and more and more convinced that as a church, we have a lot of knowledge about God here. And we don't have a whole lot of knowledge about God's presence that we've experienced person to person with God. Because maybe we haven't been mindful of it. And maybe we're loving the things of God more than we're loving God himself. And so think about the fact that Jesus obeyed God fully and God still crushed him. God never did that to anybody but Jesus. God still crushed him. Jesus is the only person who fully innocently God crushed and sent to hell. Turned his back on him on the cross. And in the midst of that, Jesus is the only person, the only human who ever truly served God for nothing with no mixed motives and went and died for him. And I think we also have to acknowledge that he died for us there. Not because we had something great to give him that he could use us for and exploit us for, but because he was interested in us. And the cross brought us to this place where Jesus and us could be in each other's presence in full harmony, in full understanding, and in full joy, And it brought us into a place where there's going to be an absolute long eternity forever, where it will all make sense and we will have that final answer. And all of the things that happen on this side of death, where God allowed suffering to refine us and take us into places, will make us great for all of eternity in the presence of God. And the gospel gives us a sign of that, gives us a glimpse of that, and gives us an avenue into being in God's presence and finding that strength and finding that joy. So I have to conclude, but I was just kind of thinking about it, because my temptation is to take music and make it my place of joy, and to start off my morning by making it my place of strength. And every single one of us has something like that, where you're taking the foundation part of your life and you're building your joy and your strength and everything else on it. But it's a thing from God rather than God himself. And I'm grateful for a glimpse, at least for about 3 months, where I couldn't really enjoy music, a glimpse of the fact that I could still enjoy God and it was actually a better joy. But I haven't arrived in it. And I know that there's more struggles and trials that are going to come, and we need to keep that conversation open. But I'd just like to invite you guys into that journey with me. And just process through, what is it that if it was taken away from you, is so foundational to you that you'd suddenly be depressed and suffering? Because that's what suffering really is, truly. It's taking the thing of life, the thing that we're clinging to, that foundational thing in us that we can control, and ripping it away. It hurts. But God's on the other end of it saying, if you weather this, you can find your strength in me, the person. You can find your joy in me, the person. Because ultimately it all comes from me anyway. And so I'd just like to invite you guys into that with me. I want to find more of God. I want to be in his presence more. I want to find my strength there. I want to find my joy there. And if it takes suffering to do it, I'm willing to go there. Are you guys willing to go there with me? So that's really all I had for today. So let me pray, and then Mark's going to come back up. God, I just thank you for the example of Job. God, I hope to one day thank him for his example, empathize with some of the pain that he went through. But God, I just thank you for Jesus, because Job and I will both get to stand before Jesus and say, that man did the ultimate for all of us. And Jesus, thank you that you went to that cross and endured that suffering for us. You can relate to our suffering, you can relate to our pain, but ultimately what your blood did on that cross was buy us into your presence. And now we have access to the throne of God. Help us as we are control freaks, holding on to our things, the good gifts you've given us, trying to squeeze life out of those rather than out of the giver of life, which is you, the only thing that can truly give us life. Help us to let those things go. Thank you for the grace that can be suffering, that brings us to the ultimate joy. Give us strength to endure that and find that joy.